Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Since she was a little girl, the wind has blown modern-day witch and chocolate maker Vianne Rocher from place to place, from a small French village to the crowded streets of Paris. Determined to still the wind and keep her daughters safe, she puts magic aside and tries to conform. But then the weather turns, and in blows a charming and enigmatic enchantress on the Day of the Dead. That's a thumbnail sketch of the latest novel by Joanne Harris. The title is The Girl with No Shadow, and it's a sequel to her first novel, Chocolat. Joanne Harris joins me in the studio. I look forward to hearing your comments this morning. Please join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Joanne, it's good to meet you.
It's very nice to be here, Diane.
I must say, I loved Chocolat. How did that idea first come to you?
Well, I'd written things in the past that had not had what you'd call enormous success, although they'd been published. I'd been writing quite a lot of kind of gothic fiction, and I wanted to get back to something that was more familiar, something that was closer to my roots. Now, I have a French mother and a large vocal French family, and I was brought up going to France every Easter and seeing the carnival and the chocolate shops and hunting for eggs in my grandfather's garden. And I thought I might start there. So I decided to write something very different, something which was essentially a kind of urban fairy story. And it grew and grew around that, and I have to say it grew rather more than I thought it would.
Did it surprise you?
Enormously, because it was exactly the opposite of what I'd been told to write.
Really?
I'd been told, well, you know, you'll never get very far writing these books about villages in Europe, and you really need to send your character to some kind of big urban setting, preferably New York. And what's with the old people? Why are you always writing about old people? Nobody wants to read about old people, and we have to have more action and more sex. And so I deliberately went off and wrote a story set in a village with lots of old people, no action, hardly any sex at all, but lots and lots and lots of chocolate.
Give us a brief recap of Chocolat.
Well, it's a fistful of dollars with chocolate. An enigmatic stranger blows into a village where everything is wrong, everyone is miserable, picks a fight with the guy in the black hat who happens to be a priest, and whammy, sorts things out. It's a very kind of light-hearted tale. It's about a woman with no sense of timing who decides to open a chocolate shop in just the wrong place, opposite the church, at just the wrong time, at the beginning of Lent, and who genuinely on some level thinks that that's not going to cause problems. Of course it does. The entire village is polarised. There becomes church factions, chocolate factions, and eventually it leads to a big conflict at Easter between the church and the chocolaterie.
And, of course, there is an elderly woman who plays an important role.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I think it's important in my stories that all the generations should play an important role, possibly because I was brought up with such an influential family, and there was my grandmother and my great-grandmother, and, you know, both of them feature quite heavily in these books in one form or another.
You're very fortunate to have had that background and that richness within your life.
I think so. I think I was lucky on several levels, partly because I had this French background and also this very different Yorkshire background. And also I was lucky enough to have grandparents and a great-grandmother who lived long enough for me to know her and to remember her. And they all told me stories, and I paid attention, I remembered them, and some of them have been recycled in these books.
So, when Chocolat was purchased to become a movie, tell us how you first learned of that.
Well, actually, I learned about it very early, long before the book was even published. And I didn't really believe that anything much was going to happen, and so I ignored it for a very long time. because I thought, you know, I'm hard-pressed enough to get a book out, let alone think about a movie. It probably won't happen.
Who approached you? How were you told?
Oh, well, nobody approached me. I think originally it was David Brown who approached my agent, and he must then have gone off to Miramax. But all of this was a rather nebulous process for me. I was still at a stage when I was working full-time. I was a teacher. I had a 4-year-old child. I felt that my life was being disrupted needlessly by all these things, and I just ignored them until finally I got Juliette Binoche on the phone going, "Hello, I'm going to be in your movie." And then I started paying attention because she isn't the sort of person that you just hang up on, actually.
Oh, she's wonderful.
She is fantastic and was a perfect choice. In fact, she was my choice. And for a long, long time, I kept talking about her and how wonderful she would be in the lead part without any interest whatever, it seemed to me, from the film company. And so it was a big surprise to me that she'd hooked the part.
Huh.
It says something about how good she is at basically getting what she wants.
Were there others who were under consideration?
I'm sure there were,
yeah.
Yes. In fact, I kept getting rumours of who they were talking to, and it was all slightly dismaying because I had a certain vision of what it would be like. And in fact, even when I was writing the book, you know, occasionally authors do these kind of sad things and they write books and they think, oh, what if there was a movie? What if I could have so-and-so in the lead role? And she was the person that I thought of instantly. And so it was a rather wonderful synchronicity, if you like, that she finally got there.
Or maybe a little magic.
Who knows?
The magic that is within Vian is truly her own, is it not?
It is. And I wanted to get away from the pyrotechnics of magic in literary terms.
Exactly.
And to enable the reader to interpret Vian's magic as and how they want. So people who want to see fairy dust can see fairy dust. And people who would rather believe that glamour, charm, enchantment, or whatever you want to call it, comes from the human heart, could also see that. So it was quite ambivalent magic, although Vian clearly believes that it exists in some way and that it set her apart.
How? How does she interpret her own magic?
Well, it's partly to do with her past and her childhood, which has been very troubled. Her mother has dragged her from one city to another for all sorts of really quite dubious reasons. And so Vian has been dependent on her mother, has never really learnt how to settle down, and has never entirely been able to interact with other people, which is ironic because she has a tremendous sense of empathy and this tremendous capability to help people out and to see to the heart of their problems, although she has never quite been able to see to the heart of her own. And this is partly, I think, what she fears, the fear that she is going to be like her mother, that she will never settle down, that her children will be like her, that they will never settle down, and that her charm and her intervention in people's lives will finally cause harm rather than good.
Joanna Harris, her new book is titled The Girl with No Shadow. It is indeed the sequel to Chocolat. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. When you began writing this, did you have a sequel in mind, or did the notion of simply beginning a new, fresh book present itself as a sequel?
I never really wanted to write a sequel. I didn't want it to be perceived as a sequel, and certainly I didn't want to do it straight away after Chocolat. I had lots of other avenues to explore. I wanted to test the boundaries and to see how far my readership would follow me. And in many ways, the fact that my readers have followed me into historical writing, into murder mystery, into short stories has given me a kind of confidence to go back to the second chapter of Chocolat, if you like, which is really quite different and which owes, I think, at least as much to my last book, Gentlemen and Players, as it does to Chocolat, because I didn't want to go back to the same village. I didn't want the characters to be the same characters. I wanted them to have evolved and changed. And in fact, 4 years have passed since Chocolat, and Vianne and her daughter Anouk have changed almost beyond recognition.
Changed their names.
They have meant, yes, many things have changed. They've changed their names in order to start anew. The location has changed.
Paris.
Vianne has gone back, yes, to Paris, the place she said she would never go back to. She has reinvented herself, allowing people to believe that she is a widow. She has, of course, a second daughter, Rosette, who has problems of her own and who is now nearly four. And she has given up many things. She's given up magic. She's even given up chocolate making because it's so convenient just to order these things from the retailer like everybody else. And she is trying very, very hard to be a regular person.
What kinds of problems does her younger daughter have?
Well, Rosette has behavioural problems, which may or may not be some kind of genetic condition, and which may be a sort of more of a kind of sense of loss of identity because none of these people really quite know who they are anymore. Anouk, of course, who is just entering adolescence, has a typical adolescence problems and has a certain number of sibling problems as well. But more importantly, has lost some of the connection she had originally with her mother because she doesn't recognise her mother anymore, and she's in the market for a role model, a new kind of influence, which is, of course, where our new character comes in and where all the source of the conflict starts.
The book is titled The Girl with No Shadow, and Joanne Harris is the author. It is indeed the sequel to Chocolat. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. If you've just joined us, Joanne Harris is with me. Her earlier book, Chocolat, was made into a film that was nominated for an Academy Award. It was a delightful film, one about a woman who breezes into town, a tiny town in France, and comes into conflict with the priest there because she establishes a wonderful chocolate shop. Her sequel, now published, is titled The Girl with No Shadow. And Joanne Harris, I hope you'll read for us. We'd love to hear a portion of the book.
Okay, now this is from the beginning of the book, and the book is written in three voices. One is Vianne's, as was Chocolat. One is Zosie's, who we'll find out about very soon, and the other one is Anouk's, the little girl who sounds really incredibly like my own daughter, Anushka.
Who is now in adolescence.
Absolutely. And who is in the market for a friend. And this is her first meeting with Zosie de l'Alba, who is the rather fantastic villain of the piece. And this is what attracts her to her first. Maybe it was because of the shoes. Those fabulous, luminous, high-heeled shoes. in lipstick, candy cane, lollipop red, gleaming like treasure on the bare cobbled street. You just don't see shoes like that in Paris. Not on regular people, anyway. And we are regular people, at least Maman says so. Though you wouldn't know it sometimes the way she goes on. Those shoes. T-t-t-t, went the lollipop shoes, and stopped right in front of the chocolaterie while their owner looked inside. From the back, at first I thought I knew her. The bright red coat that matched her shoes. Coffee cream hair tied back with a scarf. And were there bells on her print dress and a jingling charm bracelet around her wrist? And what was that? The faintest gleam in the wake of her, like something in a heat haze. The shop was shut for the funeral. In a moment she would be gone. But I really wanted her to stay. And so I did something I shouldn't. Something Maman thinks I've forgotten about. Something I haven't done for a very long time. I forked my fingers behind her back and made a little sign in the air. A breeze. Vanilla-scented, nutmeg milk. Dark roast of cocoa beans over a slow fire. It isn't magic. Really, it isn't. It's just a trick, a game I play. There's no such thing as real magic. And yet it works. Sometimes it works. Can you hear me? I said. Not in my voice, but a shadow voice, very light, like dappled leaves. She felt it then. I know she did. Turning, she stiffened. I made the door shine a little, ever so slightly, the colour of the sky. Played with it, pretty, like a mirror in the sun, shining it on and off her face. Scent of wood smoke in a cup, a dash of cream, sprinkle of sugar, bitter orange, your favourite, 70% darkest chocolate over thick-cut oranges from Seville. Try me. Taste me. Test me.
Joanne Harris reading from her new book. It's titled The Girl with No Shadow. Here is a wonderful email from Pete in Federal Hill, Baltimore. He says, I am curious as to why Ms. Harris, my wife, and it would seem most women I know, are attracted to chocolate and shoes with similar passion. Believe it or not, there is a women's shoes and chocolate store, one-stop shopping, here in Baltimore. I can't figure it out. What is the connection? Most men like beer and video games, but I can think of no food and luxury item that we naturally associate. What gives?
Well, you know, I'm not at all surprised that there's a shoe and chocolate shop there. There's definitely some kind of link. I think, actually, the link is probably, well, it's twofold. One, they're both things with no apparent practical use that transcend practicality to such an extent that really you shouldn't even ask yourself the question. Chocolate is far more than just calories. Shoes are far more than just footwear.
Absolutely.
And really, it takes a man to ask a question like that. But there's something intrinsically important about both those things, because obviously they wouldn't turn up in fairy tales as often. Take a story like The Gingerbread House, where effectively chocolate and sweets are used as a kind of metaphor for danger and temptation and magic. And take something like Cinderella, for instance, where the shoe is a lot more than mere footwear, or indeed The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy's shoes take her home, or Puss in Boots, where his magical boots give him superpowers. In Europe, we've got this enormous tradition of folklore and fairy tale, and for some reason, shoes and sweetmeats turn up in both of them. So I think there's something there in the collective unconscious, which means that we associate these things with magic, with transformation, and with the... Because, you know, ask any woman, We all believe on some level, even if you're someone like me who really only ever wears trainers, that somewhere, in some little shop somewhere, there is the pair of shoes that is going to change your life. That's going to make you into Cinderella, that is going to bring you your handsome prince.
You know, Joanne, as you were reading that passage, all I could think about was my pair of high-heeled red shoes that are all strappy. I love wearing them because they make me feel great.
Absolutely. Shoes are about not just finding something to stop you scraping your feet on the ground. They're about how it makes you feel. They're about walking tall. They're about strutting, flying. They're for anything but walking, actually. Shoes like that, they're not just footwear.
You have to talk about why there is a girl with no shadow.
Yes, indeed. Now, like shoes, the shadow, again, is a component of folklore and fairy tale. And very frequently, you have stories where the shadow exists independently and means something independently. You've got it in Peter Pan, where Peter loses his shadow. And it is something incredibly dangerous to happen because it is a loss of identity. In The Girl with No Shadow, there is a story about a boy who sells his shadow in return for eternal life. And for a very long time, he thinks that he's got a good deal. And little by little, he realises that actually he has sold an essential part of himself. Now, the parallel here is, of course, with Vian, who has sold her shadow. She hasn't realised it at first. She has done it for the best of possible reasons. But sell your shadow, and ultimately you sell your soul. Which is why she is in such a bad way in this book. She is the opposite of what she was in Chocolat, where she was the active component. She was the person there to save the villagers from themselves. Someone now needs to save her. She is in exactly the same position as the villagers in Chocolat, in that she is the one in trouble. She is waiting for somebody to come there on the wind and make everything right.
What has happened to the gypsy with whom she fell in love and who we presume has fathered her younger daughter?
Well, he's still there, but he's a nebulous figure because in the same way that Vian has made sacrifices for the sake of her children and for the stability of their lives, she has made emotional sacrifices too. And Roux, who, delightful though he is in many ways, has never quite grown up, has been left behind. He won't sacrifice his life in the way she has. He is essentially quite, he's a free spirit, but he's also quite a selfish, childish person in some ways, in that he just wants to live on the river and bum around forever. And so she has quite reluctantly left him behind and got entangled instead with another man, Thierry, who is nice in many ways, but who is very much not for her.
And whom she thinks will offer security to both her and her daughter.
Absolutely. He's a very solid citizen. He has money. He has influence. He's older than she is. He's a father figure.
What Vian does not realize is that this other woman is trying to steal her identity.
Absolutely. Now, Zuzi, who is the anti-Vian in some ways, she is the opposite of what Vian has become, looks and acts very much as Vian used to in Chocolat. She is gorgeous, she is fabulous, she doesn't care about anything or anybody, has no desire to impress, does precisely what she wants, is seductive to men, women, to children, to everybody, is magic, unashamedly so, uses magic without any kind of fear or pretense, and seems very much a kind of Mary Poppins figure who is going to bring Vian back to herself, going to teach her how to be herself, going to start her making chocolate again, going to befriend Anouk, help her with all the problems she is having. She is a little bit too good to be true. In fact, it turns out that she's somewhat more of a Cruella de Vil character than a Mary Poppins. And her agenda is fundamentally mysterious to start off with, but is all about stealing shadows. It's all about acquiring identities and appearing to other people exactly as they want her to appear. To Vian, she appears as a friend because this is what Vian wants. To Anouk, she is a slightly dangerous, evil auntie who tells her all the things that she wants to know that other grown-ups don't tell her. To Thierry, she is a wonderful, seductive woman. She is really a stealer of other people's lives.
Do you feel there is a moral to this story?
Oh, there are lots of morals, but I usually try to allow readers to find these out for themselves rather than imposing them too much, because none of my books are really a design for living. Nobody is perfect. Everybody exists in shades of grey. And so, therefore, it's a story about who you are as opposed to what other people would like you to be or what you wrote for yourself in the script years ago. It's about growing up, about the sacrifices that you sometimes have to make. And it's about courage. It's about facing up to yourself and what it means to be an individual.
At 27, before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Indianapolis. Good morning, Frances. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to let Joanne Harris know that I loved her book, Chocolat, and I loved the movie. The question I have is, how do you feel, Ms. Harris, about the change of the roles of the priest and the mayor from your book to the movie?
Well, do you know, this is a very frequent question. I've still not figured out the answer, to be honest. I knew that this was going to happen. I knew that it was a kind of non-negotiable thing, because I do think that the film industry does tend to err on the side of caution and didn't want to alienate people. And we all know, of course, that Middle America isn't quite ready for a priest to be a bad guy, because we know that no priest could ever do anything bad. And so they changed it. And yeah, I don't mind really, because this wasn't about priests. It wasn't really about Catholicism. It was about agendas. It was about how people compromised their ideology in order to establish an agenda of control. And so he could quite easily have been a mayor. In fact, he could have been a politician. He could have been anybody who does this. And it was not really something that upset me. In fact, what troubled me much more was that they morphed my daughter's invisible rabbit into a kangaroo, which gave me tremendous disapproval from Anoushka for a long, long time.
Tell me about your daughter, Anoushka, and to what extent you have morphed her into Anouk.
Well, I haven't morphed her. I don't think I have. What I've done is I have borrowed little characteristics and bits of and
such
pieces.
Such as?
Well, for instance, Chocolat I wrote when she was 4. I made her a little bit older. I made her just coming up to 6. But Anouk has a great deal in common with Anoushka, partly her general free-spiritedness and, of course, her invisible friend, Pantoufle, who at the time was very much a force in our household, and you couldn't sit on various chairs because Pantoufle was there, and if she had an ice cream, Pantoufle would have to have one too, which I have to say was a pretty good deal. And it was inevitable that she would be the template in some ways. Chocolat is very much a kind of love story between a mother and her child, and The Girl With No Shadow is the continuation of that relationship, as that very simple mother-daughter-child relationship becomes something just a little bit more challenging as the
complicated
child enters that, yes, that age, that certain age.
Exactly.
And some of it became about her and the problems she was having at school and just the way she was changing into a little individual of her own. And some of it was about the fears that you have as a parent, because I think, as I have Vian say somewhere in the book, nobody tells you this, but actually to be a parent is on some level to be afraid for the rest of your life. Nobody tells you at first. You kind of discover this on the way. And because this is a book very much about what makes you afraid, obviously I was going to tap into some of that.
What about your relationship with your own mother?
Well, I've always had a very good relationship with her, in the same way that, you know, my relationship with Anoushka is actually much less troubled than Vian's relationship with Anouk. But she is of a certain generation and of a certain type. She was always very authoritative and rather strict and rather demanding. Maybe this is why the heroines that I write always have slightly edgy relationships with their mothers. And there is always a kind of power struggle going on.
Do you think that that is the norm?
I don't think there is a norm where relationships are concerned. I think that there's such a diversity, and relationships generally are so complicated that, you know, all I do, I don't do portraits, but I do draw upon the things that have struck me in the past, or things that may have happened to me or to others in the past.
Joanne Harris, her new book is titled The Girl with No Shadow. And if you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Her book is the sequel to her earlier book, Chocolat. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. By the Overbrook Foundation, supporting Catalog Choice, a service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail at catalogchoice.org. And by UVA's Miller Center, presenting a national debate, Is Healthcare a Right? Video, transcript, and broadcast details are at millercenter.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez tells us about his encounter 3 years ago with a homeless street musician that led to a life-changing friendship. Lopez sought to understand the mental illness that wrecked a promising music career. The relationship led to a series of columns, a new book, and a movie now in production. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
One of our listeners, Mary, would like to know, is the girl with no shadow, the Lollipop Shoes, as published in the UK? If so, why the change of title for the US?
You know, it is the same book, and I have absolutely no idea why they changed the title, in the same way that I never know why they changed the book jackets. It's just one of those things. It's probably something to do with marketing, which is a concept that I just don't even think about most of the time. But yes, I'm glad you brought it up, because I wouldn't like people to buy it twice and to find that it's the same book.
Did you not offer any objections?
Oh, yes, I offered plenty of objections, but they kept pushing and pushing at it. And actually, the thing is, I'm now published in something like 48 different countries, and I can't possibly understand the different market forces that drive all of them. And so, you know, I just have to take advice.
Joanne, your life has changed a lot, I would think, since the publication of Chocolat.
Well, I get around a bit more, yes.
But talk about that. I mean, you live in the same village with your parents. You told me that they're just within 10-minute walking distance. You have a close relationship with them, as does your daughter. Your husband does all of the financial work to keep everything going. That's a real change for you, I would think.
It is a bit of a change. Before that, I was a teacher. I was working so hard that I rarely got time to see anybody much. I still lived very close to my parents, but in a different place. My husband was working in the building industry. So basically, I've got a new job and things have reshuffled. I don't think of it as an enormous kind of life change, because I don't think I've changed, really. But certainly it's given me a lot of possibilities, and I've travelled far more than I would possibly have done. I've been to so many different countries. I've been to Australia and all round Eastern Europe, and to Egypt and Brazil, and I've gone down the Congo in a canoe, and I've met the Queen, and I've met the Prime Minister, and I've met loads of movie stars, and I've been to the Oscars biting my nails trying to figure out whether my movie would get one. And it's all rather glam, actually.
Is this book going to become a movie?
It would be nice, wouldn't it? I don't know. I really can't say at this stage, but it would be very nice, especially if we could have the same cast.
You can't say, or you don't know?
I can't say, because, sadly, I have no idea whatever. These things, I think, you know, they're best left ignored until something happens, because options get picked up, they get
sure.
put down again,
sure.
and they take absolutely ages. But it would be nice.
It would indeed. Let's go to Concord, North Carolina. Good morning, Susan.
Yes, this is Sue. Hey, I just wanted to thank Ms. Harris for some of the books that my husband and I enjoy reading together, probably more than any other book. We are huge fans. I've noticed that there seems to be an occasional theme of a gypsy spirit, and through some of your other novels, and especially this one. And I'm only on chapter 5, so I'm trying not to listen too hard.
Oh, right. I'll not tell you how it ends.
Please don't. I've been to work late twice in a row because I'm not up late.
Excellent. I love that.
But is the magic a particular, are you just looking for somebody's inner magic, or is it taken from more of a traditional outlook of what we think of gypsies?
Well, it's a good question. I think particularly in Europe, we've got such an enormous tradition of magic in folklore that I think it's almost inevitable that somebody who was brought up on those stories, as I was, would kind of weave them in. And I also think that particularly at the rate at which the world is changing, we do need that concept within the stories that we read. I think we all rather like the idea that we could just up sticks and move somewhere, drift with the wind, do what we liked, say what we liked, eat what we liked. And I think we also live in the continuing hope that there is something there that will enable us to change our lives, because we don't feel terribly in control. So the concept of magic as a kind of means of self-expression, I think, is extremely attractive.
Yeah. I was particularly, I almost cried when I realized the transformation of Jan, or at least the temporary transformation, because she's lost so much of that. And I was always kind of lived vicariously through her character in Chocolat.
But without telling you the end, don't worry too much.
Okay.
This is high noon, remember.
Real quickly, the concept of the black man reminds me so much of the character in Holy Fools.
Yes, you're right. Holy Fools is a kind of relative to Chocolat in some
Absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely, and my favourite.
So. Well, I'm fond of it too, and I really do enjoy those characters enormously. I wrote Holy Fools actually before I wrote Chocolat, which is why they have so many things in common, and then I kind of rewrote it for publication later. But yes, there's definitely an element of wandering people, sometimes good and sometimes bad. Because actually, what self-respecting story doesn't start with a mysterious stranger blowing into town?
Susan, thanks for your call. Here is an email from Alexis, who says, I love Ms. Harris's books, but was more taken with Five Quarters of the Orange, the main character using an orange to trigger her mother's migraines so she could go on adventures just intrigued me. It sounded so much like a story my grandmother would make up to keep her small grandchildren entertained. Was this something Ms. Harris actually encountered, or was it just an idea that came to her?
Well, this is a story that's made up of so many components, and one of them is indeed something that I actually encountered at the time when I wrote this book, which I have to say is probably the darkest and the edgiest of my books. I was having terribly bad migraines and very bad insomnia. And I think in many ways I kind of projected myself into that central character of the mother who at one point writes in her diary, "I would sell my children for a night's sleep." It takes you to some quite dark places. And it's interesting that you should mention your grandmother, because this story came very much from my grandfather, my French grandfather, who knew the war, who was in an occupied village interacting with the Gestapo, and who at one point was actually on the run from them, having been denounced by a neighbour, and who ended up on a farm with his children in much the same way that Mirabelle, the mother, ends up with her children trying to run a farm on her own. And so some of the story came out of his stories and the things that he told me, because as a small child I was very interested in my grandfather's stories of the war. And so many of them made it into the final mix without it really being a portrait of him. It was very much a portrait of the kind of little community that he inhabited at the time, and that the terrible tensions that that come from that situation.
Such an important factor to tell stories within a family.
Absolutely. I think, you know, children who have the luck to have two sets of grandparents and the patience to listen to them have such an enormous advantage in life.
Indeed. Let's go now to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. Miss Harris, I want to tell you I've really enjoyed reading your novels. I prefer your later novels to Chocolat. I particularly like 4 5/4 of the Orange, and I particularly like Gentlemen and Players. I wanted to ask, the habit of concealment, total concealment in the case of 5 5/4 of the Orange and in Gentlemen and Players, and hiding, you know, as again in Holy Fools, where people pretend to be totally different from who they are and make people believe it. This theme is seems to be constant in your books, and could you talk a little more about that?
You're right, it is constant, and it's here again in The Girl with No Shadow, because this is all about identity. And I think identity is another of those kind of fairy tale components that pop up in the folklore of Europe, because much of fairy tale is about people pretending to be what they're not, taking disguises.
Or being transformed.
Or being transformed, in fact, against their will. And I've always thought that, you know, from a kind of post-Freudian perspective, it was very much a kind of investigation of the identity and what makes up the personality. I don't know, maybe it's because, maybe there's something to do with me, maybe psychologically this is something to do with me. I've always been the kind of person who didn't want to push themselves forward and who was always quite happy to be as inconspicuous as possible. As a child, my greatest dream was to have an invisibility cloak and just to be able to move around and watch people without being seen. Perhaps I've brought that out in some of my stories, because I really do quite enjoy writing these characters.
You said earlier you suffered migraines. Do
I
you
did.
Still have them?
Not anymore, no.
Did the orange do it for you?
No, I used the orange as a symbol for a number of reasons, partly because it is a very frequent migraine trigger, but also because I think the idea of the forbidden fruit is very strong in that book. And the idea that food can be polarised into a sort of negative aspect, because I'd written so much about the positive aspects of food and its nostalgia and the joy that it gives people, I wanted to write a much darker book about the tensions and the negativities of food and the idea of deprivation and wartime, and also the idea that, you know, you could use this fruit in a sort of sinister, malicious way.
How did you manage to get beyond your migraines?
I quit my job and I started writing full time.
That's a wonderful answer. Now to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning. I was just wondering, as I was listening earlier to her reading the excerpt from the book, will you be producing this on tape by any chance, a recording of you reading the story?
Do you know, I'd love to do that, but nobody ever asks me, except members of the public. In fact, there is an audiobook. It's a terrific audiobook, and it should be out pretty much now, but it's not me reading it.
Too bad.
Well, just the challenge of flying me over and getting me to spend hours in a studio is probably a bit much. But at some point, I will probably do one of my own audiobooks. In fact, I've got on my website my nice techie guy who puts all the stuff up on my website for me is trying to put some podcasts of me reading short stories up there, because I do get asked to read to people, and I think people like to be read to.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. And now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning. There's a wonderful book that explains the power of shoes. History. It's called Blood, Bread, and Roses by Judy Gron. It also has food references in it. Joanne, I think you would find it very, very useful.
Oh, I'll definitely check it out. I'll have a look for it. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for calling, Ruth. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Bethesda, Maryland. Hi there, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. First of all, Ms. Harris, you cannot write fast enough. You're one of those authors that I just wait and wait and wait. I would bated breath to see what your next thing is going to be. But what I would like to hear you comment on, I'm a teacher who quit my job very recently. How you managed to teach and write in the first place is amazing, but could you tell me about your teaching career and its influence on your books? Because, as I remember, that was a male school, boys' school.
It was, yes. It was a very male environment.
Correct. And yet your books are such an exploration of the feminine. Could you come?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I mean, I was not an English teacher. I was a teacher of French and German. And I happened to end up in a boys' school entirely by accident. It was just the first job that was given to me. And it was a very strange environment at first. It was extremely old-fashioned. It was extremely male. As a woman, as one of, I think, five women in a staff of 200-odd, you had to be much tougher than anybody else because people would otherwise take advantage. And strangely enough, I took to it. I rather enjoyed that environment.
How long were you there?
I taught there for 15 years, and it's the only school I've ever taught in where I could see gargoyles out of my window. And some of them were actually members of staff, but some of them were actual gargoyles. The place was built in 1552, can you believe it?
But you know, Joanne, you speak of it with pleasure.
Oh, yeah, I liked the place. I got rather fond of it.
And yet there's another part of you that seems so relieved at having left it behind.
Well, 15 years is a long time.
And free of migraines.
Well, yes, quite. It was a very stressful job. It was a very high-powered kind of academic pressure cooker. You never had any time. But it was also, and I think this is the second part of the question here, it was a very stimulating environment. There were a lot of interesting people there. Some of them made their way into books in one way or another. And it was the kind of job where you are constantly meeting challenges because you never quite know what's around the corner. And I think that as a writer, that was a very useful thing because, well, obviously what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but it also makes you more creative. And I think it was very clear, even from the start, even in Chocolat, that on some level I wasn't just writing about a little French village. I was writing about a small community under pressure, which has always been Leeds Grammar School.
She also asked how you managed to write and teach.
With some difficulty. But I got very good at using whatever time was available. Sometimes it wasn't a lot of time, but I got quite good at sitting down for an hour or half an hour and doing some writing, as opposed to having unlimited time waiting for ideal circumstances and then waiting for the muse to clock in. Actually, I don't think I ever had a muse in that respect. I don't think I could have afforded one. And so I got quite good at writing in the little intervals of time that were available and on trains and, you know, at moments
wherever.
In the staff room, which is actually what I still do. And so it was good training.
Joanna Harris, her new book, which is the sequel to Chocola, is titled The Girl with No Shadow. Congratulations, Joanne, really.
Why, thank you. I've enjoyed this so much. It's been such good fun actually writing this that I always get a kick out of people enjoying reading it too, because obviously that's what it's for.
Indeed. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.